This is All Sides Weekend. I'm Marilyn Smith. We're taking a look at all things literary on this All Sides Weekend. Joining me this morning, WOSU book reviewer Cassie Rose and poet and Capital University professor Kevin Griffith. Good morning.
Good morning, Marilyn.
As I mentioned in the open of the show, there's a growing debate and some tension, frankly, about the role of libraries in this age of electronic books. Eli Nyberger is the director of IT and production at the District Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Part of the models that we've seen so far are still trying to force 20th century business models onto digital content, and any digital native says, what, you mean I have to wait to download an ebook? What sense does that make? And they're off to the Kindle store to spend, what, you know, $3.99 or $4.99 or $9.99 to get that same book.
Cassie Rose, I know you have a Kindle. Kevin, I'm not so sure about you. I could have guessed. There is this growing debate over how libraries fit these electronic books into their business, what they do. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, if you're going to lend an electronic book, it's going to be a very different transaction than if you go to the library and take out, well, they are not brick-and-mortar books, you know, actual physical books.
Yes, and I think it's a challenge both for the library and for the consumer. I mean, as we just heard, the consumer expects an instant download. Is that expectation something that we're, I mean, we've been set up to expect newspapers to be free, and the New York Times had to unhook themselves from that after years and years of trying to figure out that kind of model. In the library situation, it's very different because we have to think of what is the role of the library and in the digital environment. Are they someone that needs to act like they do now? They are the place where you go to get a book that you don't want to buy. For them, then, they have to have a whole new strategy because with the print book, they buy it once and they own it forever. With the digital model, they don't. And there's an in-between person, too. They don't buy it from the publisher. They buy it from, you know, some middle person. And then it becomes, if they get one book, let's say the publisher gives them one book at the New York Public Library, can anybody nationally get on and get that book? And you know, how many downloads should it be? And the other thing is that right now they're having to pay the top price, whereas for books, print books, they get a 40% discount. So already they're in the hole. And then if, as was in the news, HarperCollins put a cap at 26 downloads, and that's what caused the furor with the libraries and actually opened the discussion. I think it was very bold for HarperCollins to do it, to get things going. So now the mess is out there of how many downloads, what are the expectations of the consumers, what is the role of the library in with digital books. And also then I get questions of how do the digital books work for the consumer when we like to browse and we make choices based on what we've come upon at the library. If they're only in digital books, how do we get that book choice by chance that comes along? There are huge and multifold issues that go on here that really, I think, keeps the jury out on what's going to happen.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think this move by HarperCollins did open up the discussion, which was bound to occur anyway. Kevin.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's interesting what you opened the show with. You remember that Cassie did have a Kindle, and I haven't purchased one yet. I think we are right on the cusp of I was at a conference at OSU this weekend, the Digital Media in a Social World, and we're right on the cusp of having lots and lots of text and music stored in the cloud, as it's called, cloud computing, and everybody's going to have a tablet computer and be doing downloads that way. And so that's the way the world's heading. But I think for discriminating readers, Kindles are a problem. Cassie, maybe you want to talk about that because you don't use your Kindle that much anymore. Maybe you wanted to explain why. That's interesting.
Now, I recall at first you were very enthusiastic about it.
Well, I was because I thought I'm going to read the books here that normally I would go out and buy a paperback with. Well, none of them were available on Kindle. So it was, one, the availability of the books that I wanted weren't there. And I was told, well, over time they will be. And I'm not so sure that's true. Because I don't turn to it anymore. The other is my experience with the book gets I just face obstacles because I may put a book down and go back to it 3 months later, and I want to flip through the book. I want to read a couple chapter headings. I want to read maybe the marginalia that I've written in the book. So I have to have the book in my hand so I can go back and forth, and I couldn't do that with the Kindle. Now, it does have those capabilities, so does the Nook, and I'm sure all of the e-readers are going to continue to become more sophisticated, but in the wholeness of the experience, it doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm. And nothing against our libraries. Columbus Metropolitan Library is an incredible system.
Yeah,
love,
it's been
love the library.
Number one in the nation.
But they're and they are getting on this e-reader bandwagon. And if you go to their website, you see reviews of all the various e-readers. But even what you can get from our library, what you can check out from the Columbus Library, huge system, is very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what is it? Only about 20,000 books, which mm-hmm. is microscopic in the big picture. And I thought, well, maybe I will get, you know, a Nook or something and use it at the library. And then I looked at what they actually had, and I said, this isn't really worth it. I think I'd just be better off just scanning, mm-hmm. and, you know, browsing the bookshelves, seeing what's coming in. That's always so exciting. And so that there, it's still very limited. I think the media is really sort of on a rampage and playing this up and how revolutionary this is. But I think most of us are still want that experience mm-hmm. of browsing a bookshelf. But
well, and at the same time, you have that tension of, at least here in Ohio, a state budget that has been very restricted. Libraries are often among the first, as are most of the arts, among the first to lose or see funding kind of fade away. Mm-hmm. And the Columbus Public Library is downtown, has wonderful resources. But when you get out to some of these smaller places, I would think that this is just at its beginning,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of these very small libraries that lack the same resources haven't really delved into electronic books at all.
Well, it is a funding issue. And the thing about technology is that it always changes. Again, when you have the print book, you have the print book, mm-hmm. and there it is. Whereas, you know, if the e-readers change, if the technology gets more sophisticated, it puts the libraries in the position where they have to keep up with the technology. And how do they have the funding to do that? I mean, we all see that with our computers and the software that we buy. And every 3, 4, 5 years, you know, your laptop is out of date.
Well, going from tapes to DVDs, mm-hmm. the entire technology mm-hmm. changed, and people have to make fairly sizable investments mm-hmm. to keep up.
Mm-hmm. And the terrible thing here, like you mentioned, this is interesting with music too, is that one would think, oh, from a budgetary standpoint, this is great because now we don't have to buy these paper books and store them. But in many cases, the electronic versions are more expensive mm-hmm. than the paper versions with music as well. It's often much cheaper to buy the actual CD than the MP3 download, mm-hmm. I've noticed. And so that makes no sense from an economic standpoint mm-hmm. either.
292-8513, this is All Sides Weekend. I'm Marilyn Smith. We're talking about books and literary issues this morning with WOSU book reviewer Cassie Rose and poet and Capital University professor Kevin Griffith. One of the things, though, that is going to change is the mindset of our children. Already they're much more computer savvy than we certainly were, and there are going to be kids in the future who don't know books. I don't know how they deal with children's books and the so important pictorial aspect of a children's book. When you're talking about an e-reader, I suppose it's all contained there. But, of course, we have things like pop-up books, and, you know, I don't know how mm-hmm. that all mm-hmm. translates. But there are going to be kids who will never know life without e-books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just reminded of, I think it was about a month ago, there was an article in the New York Times about how picture books, children's picture books, are way on the decline. Mm-hmm. Sales are way down on those because I think a lot of parents are giving their kids iPads or iPods, and that's the way they're getting their visual stimulation, and that's the way they're reading. It's rather sad.
Well, and of course, being read to was a ritual mm-hmm. in my house when my children were growing up, and it's one thing that is sort of a precursor to reading on your own when you mm-hmm. hear a book over and over. I remember my daughter, I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, she's heard this book so many times. She's just reading along, mimicking, mm-hmm. you know, what I say because she's committed it to memory. And we got a new book from the library, and she picked it up and started to read it. Well, it seemed to be a seamless transition from being a listener to becoming a reader.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I also think the jury is out on, is the psychological effect of the electronics. And certainly that's widespread in terms of all electronics in our life, because it's affecting everything from banking to reading to our iPods, our Blackberries. But what is the effect on children who are going to be reading just from e-readers or from their parents' iPods? I was having my hair cut a couple weeks ago, and I'm sitting there with my book, and a dad comes in with his son, who looked about like he was, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5, and his father handed him his iPod and put something on it, visual or whatever, and I thought, I was sitting next to him, and I thought, boy, this is certainly a statement of the times, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
But I do wonder how it will visually and learning abilities and the way kids relate to objects and people and language if they're just taught on electronic books. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I have a colleague at the law school and a very conscientious fellow about his children and their reading habits, and he had a completely different take on this. I thought it was interesting. He bought both of his children Kindles, mm-hmm. and his reason was, well, I gave them both Kindles because really the only thing you can do on a Kindle is read. It's a limited device, right? You can marginally scan the web, but it's very slow, and it's not, kids aren't going to like that. So he said, what he said is it satisfies their need to be having like an electronic device and looking at one, but they know that all they're doing on it is reading. So I think that's a good compromise.
Good.
They're not texting their friends or on social media or something. They can
or
just
getting
read.
Into places where they might
that's right.
not.
So I think that's a good argument, I guess. Kids are always going to want gadgets, and give them the one that at least forces them to read. You know?
It gives them the chance also to read the books that maybe their parents don't want them to read, although I'm sure that there will be safety devices on it.
That's
but
right.
I know growing up, there was a point where when Rosemary's Baby came out, I really wanted to read that book, and my mother wouldn't let me, and I had to wait a couple of years. But, you know, if you have a Kindle, you know, you can download, because, you know, you can't see, because you can't see the book cover.
Yeah, that's right.
When you're reading it.
So it's the brown paper wrapping the comic book or whatever.
Yeah, I wonder if you can get Henry Miller on Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
Well, I do. I have a completely different memory. When Catcher in the Rye came out, my mother went to the store and bought it for me because she thought, I'm going to get my hands on it anyway. She might as well give it to me. And there is some question about whether or not it's worth banning books, and it's something that I think we'll talk about a little later in the program regarding this new book about Mahatma Gandhi. You know, if there is any benefit to anyone, because it certainly heightens the curiosity and the determination to get that book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with kids.
Yeah. And from a poet standpoint, if you're a poet like Allen Ginsberg, remember Howl? His great, great poem, Howl, in the book had the obscenity trial. And the best thing that can happen to you is get someone to attempt to ban your book or label it as obscene. That's the sure step to fame, right?
Yeah. Sometimes that's right. 292-8513. This is All Sides Weekend with Kevin Griffith and Cassie Rose. We're talking about books, and we'll be back after a short break.
All week, political observers were obsessed with trying to find out if a government shutdown would happen or not. The key, as it turns out, was John Boehner's tears. If he's crying, government shutdown. If he's not crying, he's asleep. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for a catharsis-filled news quiz. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. It's 54 degrees in downtown Columbus. And rain showers off and on throughout the day. A thunderstorm possible, especially after 2 this afternoon, and a high near 64. A slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 48, and a partly sunny and warm weekend with a high of 72 on Saturday.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Juan and John April 7th through the 10th. Solo performer Roger Guenver Smith brings to life the story of two baseball legends' violent encounter at home plate in 1965. More at wexarts.org.
All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 and NPR News.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Smith. It's 21 minutes now past 11 o'clock. We're talking about books here on All Sides Weekend. And my guests this morning are Cassie Rose, who does book reviews here at WOSU, along with poet and English professor at Capital University, Kevin Griffith. Kevin, you have just been published once again in an English anthology of poetry. What is this book?
Well, I wanted to talk about it because you had mentioned that Billy Collins was on Talk of the Nation this week. Let's all remind all the listeners, it is National Poetry Month. Yes. April's National Poetry Month.
The cruelest month.
Yeah, that's right. We're all supposed to promote poetry this month, so I'm trying to do that. But I was really delighted when a few months ago I got an email from an editor in England, Neil Astley, who's the editor at Blood Axe Books. Blood Axe has been going on for a long time. They published Ted Hughes, Poet Laureate of England, many other people.
And Billy Collins is the former Poet Laureate of the United States.
And Blood Axe has put together a series of anthologies. The first one is called Staying Alive, and the second one was called Being Alive, and the third one, this one that just came out, is called Being Human. And they actually took one of my poems for the anthology, and I was just delighted. And I received my author's copy earlier this week, and it's a great anthology. It's an incredibly comprehensive anthology. It has T.S. Eliot in it, Love Song of Jailford, Prufrock.
So I figured, you're in good company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I figured that's it. I'm never writing anything again because this is as good as it gets. But it's wonderful. And what I wanted to talk about, too, is I know Billy Collins was being asked, Why doesn't anyone read poetry anymore? And why doesn't anyone, why don't poetry books sell anymore? But I wanted to make this assertion that things are good in England. I mean, poetry books sell quite a lot of copies in England. It's like a bizarro world. Over there, they are reading poetry. The first installment in this anthology, Staying Alive, was a bestseller in England and sold over 150,000 copies. That's unheard of in the United States.
Well, perhaps one of the reasons that Billy Collins is still popular and his work is still popular, although he has gotten a lot of criticism, is its so-called accessibility.
That's
and we
right.
have a cut with him on Talk of the Nation this week explaining or kind of defending his work.
I think accessibility is actually, in poetry, a strategy for me. It's a way of getting the reader into the poem, access the poem. Once the reader gets into the poem, I'm hoping that less accessible things start happening as the reader is moved into worlds that are a little more challenging, a little more hypothetical, and finally a little more mysterious.
At first he called his critics ankle biters. He wasn't too pleased with this.
Yes, yeah.
But there isn't anything wrong, is there, with writing a poem that someone can understand as opposed to some of these flowery, showy odes or whatever that people just come away and say, I'm not sure what that's about.
Well, that was Neil Astley's whole point in putting together this anthology, is that this was meant to be for a general audience. These anthologies, Being Human is the latest one. And it's interesting, he received a lot of criticism from poets in Britain about, this is so middle brow, what are you doing, doesn't ask the readers, but you have to think about, if you want to have a readership, you have to think about readers. And I know there are a lot of poets who are like artistes, and that's the last thing you want to do is think about a readership. Well, then expect that not a lot of people are going to read you. But clearly that works to put together an anthology of accessible poems, because it was successful beyond anyone's wildest hopes, I would think.
But it's almost like any product that you create. If people don't want it, what's
right.
the point?
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say that I think that with poetry, maybe we put too much expectation on it, that we demand it, all of it, to be accessible. Well, my approach to poetry is I continually look for the poet that resonates with me. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of accessibility. It's what I understand. Maybe it's a poet who writes prose poems and tells stories in them. Maybe it's someone like W.S. Merwin. I love W.S. Merwin's poetry. Mary Oliver, certainly. Would people say she's accessible? Yes, she is. Beautiful poetry. I was browsing in the library the other day, picked up a collection by Sharon Olds from the 1990s. It's more of me finding what works for me. What do I love about this
book? But
that's
a form of accessibility, don't you think?
Well, what about if you compare that with novels? There are a lot of people that will pick up novels that are, say, this is too dense for me. I don't like Henry James. He makes me work too hard. Or, the the literary novels that we talk about, they make me work too hard. I don't want to work, so I want more of a bestseller that's about vampires and be entertained. Well, that works with poetry, I think, too. And maybe Billy Collins is on this accessibility level of more entertaining, more, you could say, poetry light. I don't know. And where's the line between him and Rod McEwen? Who came out in the, was he 70s?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a line.
Seasons in the Sun, right?
Yeah, so I don't know. I think maybe we put so much on it because in school we've had to read the very difficult. Like, I can't get through it. Stephen Crane, is it the Bridge?
Mm-hmm. Heart Crane.
Heart Crane. Mm-hmm. Stephen Crane was the Red Badge of Courage.
That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Heart Crane. So difficult. And I know I wouldn't be able really to read that and understand it unless I have a professor go through it with me, which I'm open to and love. But again, I wonder if we're bashing poetry that is not accessible in a way that's like saying, well, that's bashing Henry James or William Faulkner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that it necessarily has to be bashed, but there does seem to be some bashing going on. What do you find with your students in your poetry classes, Kevin?
Well, I was going to say, just before I talk about that, it was really interesting, and there are a lot of people who are really hostile to Billy Collins in the United States. He gets really savage reviews. I like Billy Collins, by the way. But I remember one review that said, the next time you see Billy Collins, walk up to him and bite him right on the face. I mean, that's pretty bad.
That's to the point.
Because a lot of people are really jealous of his success, and they're jealous of the way he got his success by writing poetry that people can engage with, and that's humorous. I think the difference between a Billy Collins and a Rob McEwen is Rob McEwen is a bad poet who takes himself seriously. Billy Collins is a good poet who doesn't take himself so seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that's the that's
well, does
the
that element of humor somehow lower his standing as well? Do people
think that's
easy?
That's always a big problem. If you're a humorist, people think all of a sudden you're in a lower echelon of art or something. I don't agree with that at all.
Mm-hmm. But I know some of your poems are funny, but yet they really make you think.
Mm-hmm. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what Sir Philip Sidney said the whole purpose of poetry was, to teach and delight, right? And a lot of people forget the delight part, I think. Billy Collins didn't.
Yeah. And don't you think also the difference in Britain is that, I mean, they do have a very different kind of literary bent.
Yes.
I mean, if you read the Times Literary Supplement and the London Review of Books, I mean, you have to be committed to reading these publications, and they are long and thoughtful reviews of books. And it tells me, because I get both of them, it tells me that over time I've learned that they're reading desires, popularity, what they gravitate to, what their readers expect is much different than what we expect.
Mm-hmm. But it's that whole electronic age, too, where we want it quickly, we want it easy, we want it bright and fun, and we don't want to sit there and pore over each and every word necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, frankly, I think things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
We do have an email from Mike, who is someone who's contemplating entering into a master's program in library science as a way to begin an encore career in the field of librarianship. Do our guests have any thoughts on the viability of the future of libraries and librarians, given the change in technology? Are these all going to be IT people in the future?
Mm-hmm. I read in the Dispatch, this is interesting because of my students. I mean, what do you do with an English major? That's the question always. What do you do with creative writing? I believe there was an article in the Dispatch not too long ago that said that library science is going to be one of those fields that's going to explode in the near future. There may be a 20% increase in the need for librarians in the future.
And what did they base that on?
Because librarians are becoming, libraries are becoming so much more than,
kind
as
of
you
multimedia
know, than books.
Sources.
They're like community centers, right? Resource centers for people who need job applications and job training, tutoring centers. They're becoming like the center of the community, and they're hiring. I've had several of my students have been hired at libraries recently and worked at libraries and are entering library science
programs. These are English
majors? That's a great field.
Well, it's a center also that fosters literacy in a community and also gets reading out into the community with all of the programs, especially into disadvantaged areas, you know, taking books out there. And I was, a long time ago, I had a conversation with Patrick Lisinski, and he was saying one of their programs was that they would have lunch and then also have reading. And, of course, a lot of the people came to get the lunch to get food. Mm-hmm. But in that place, they were able to introduce books to the moms and their children.
They're food mm-hmm. for the mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and as we've talked more and more in the news department, as funding for everything seems to go down, you know, free cheese from the government or butter, you know, things that used to be taken for granted are no longer available. And we've seen food lines grow and grow and grow. And I suppose you have to be part sociologist and part librarian in order to deal with all of these mm-hmm. things, plus job counseling, as you say. I know mm-hmm. Our reporters have gone out and covered yes. some of these events at libraries.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten what I was going to say, sorry. One of the other things I think about libraries is, yes, you're going to have to do so much more. And, you know, in the media now, a lot of public employees are under attack, you know, teachers and police officers, firefighters, but you never hear anyone attacking librarians. I think for a lot of people, libraries are kind of sacred places. People don't mm-hmm. want to touch them. That's
another
reason.
Well, they are regarded as temples yeah, of books.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's enough. And you never hear anybody complaining, I've never had that librarians aren't working hard enough, right? I mean, they mm-hmm. seem very busy and mm-hmm. they're always engaged, and at least at the Whetstone Library, always trying new initiatives. They work very hard, and so that's good. They're sort of under that whole nasty budget stuff, that radar. So I
or
think
above
that's
it, yeah.
Yeah, or above it, yeah, above the fray, I would say, yeah.
They're also the place, too, for the reference librarians are there to help. There, certainly, we've got the web. We can all be our own researchers, but there are many times where I couldn't find it on the web, and I've called a reference librarian. And because also the library has databases available that I don't have mm-hmm. available on the web, or they are available to us as consumers, and they took me through the steps on their site of where I could access it. And it's just, again, books have so many multi-levels to them. It's not like music or CD or whatever and the sound. It's what is the role of the book and how many ways it is used, whether it's, you know, archival material, reference material, entertainment reading material, literacy that is so important to getting jobs. It is so multifaceted that I think that I tend to agree that libraries are going to become a stronghold.
Mm-hmm. Well, then your advice to Mike is go for it.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if I were in this economy, if I were coming out of school and looking for a second job, I would do that. Library science, definitely.
292-8513. Mm-hmm. We're talking about books with WOSU book reviewer Cassie Rose and with poet and English professor at Capital University, Kevin Griffith. You also have gotten an advanced copy, I think both of you have actually, of Donald Ray Pollack's new novel. We interviewed Don Pollack about his book, Knock 'em Stiff, and he was also a guest, I think, with Christopher Purdy mm-hmm. on this program. There are great expectations after his first book, Knock 'em Stiff, of short stories came out. I got a huge write-up in the New York Times, was heralded as one of the best new writers, you know, in the universe, I think. Mm-hmm. And there are great expectations for this second book, which is a novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called It's called The Devil All the Time. The Devil All the Time. That's his new novel. It's due out July 2011. I happen to get, and Cassie got one too, but you haven't read it yet. Right?
I haven't read it yet, no. Okay. It's still on my reading table.
As soon as I got it in my hands, I read it. And and I must say it's, I don't want to give too much away. Mm-hmm. That's not fair, but I would say it's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome
it
novel.
It will live up to expectations
yeah, yes.
then.
Yeah. It is not, it is set in Knock 'em Stiff again, so it's another Knock 'em Stiff type novel. But Donald Ray Pollack did not do what a lot of short story writers do, and I admire him for this, is a lot of times you read someone like Dan Shaun, who's a great short story writer, then you read his novels, and you can tell they're just short stories extended or blown up.
Or strung together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, strung together, sectional short stories or something. He did not do this. What he did is wove together multi-narratives in a very ingenious way but being very accessible all the time. And it is like Knock 'em Stiff. It is not for the faint of heart. It's a brutal, violent, funny, spiritual in many ways, asks a lot of questions about what it means to seek revenge on someone, what it means to ask for a favor from God and not get it, and how do you deal with that? It has serial killers in it. It has I get carnival freaks in it. I mean, you know, it's the whole Donald Pollock thing. But the devil all the time, it's well worth it. And I would say this is a good thing to see. It's a good thing to see that he took the springboard of Knock 'Em Stiff, and now he's springing off of that into even greater territory.
Well, we should give a little bit of background about Donald Ray Pollock. He was a graduate student at Ohio State in the Creative mm-hmm. Writing Program, which is a very rigorous program. This was a man who, I think at age 50, had worked
40s, I think. Mm-hmm. I think
30 years in a paper mill.
Well, he had worked a long time in this paper mill down in Chillicothe, and always had the dream, even though he was probably an unlikely successful writer, always had the dream of writing. And finally, I think, enrolled in undergraduate school at OU, one of the branch mm-hmm. campuses down in southern Ohio, and then came up here, was accepted in the creative writing program, and wrote this book of short stories, Knock 'Em Stiff, and it really knocked everybody's socks off. Mm-hmm. But the book did take some criticism, and Cassie, I think that you were a little put off. It was very dark, very gritty, and there were a lot of people who just didn't want to read it.
Well, they couldn't get past the second story.
Yes, I've heard that mm-hmm. many, many
because
times.
Because the second story was particularly violent. And, you know, my take on the book was to say that, yes, it is violent, and it is hard to read, and it's not for the faint of heart, as Kevin has said. However, where I thought his brilliance is in that book, he brought into print a reality that of a way of life. Mm-hmm. So in one of the stories, it's a matter, there's someone who pulls up beside this car of these characters that he's following, the car, and they're going to give blood so that they can get money. And the car, I think, is a Lexus or a Mercedes. And I thought, how many times do people, you know, pull up to a traffic light in southern Ohio, they're passing through, maybe traveling or something, and don't give the time of day to what they see next to them in this beat-up car and people who look probably really down and out? Well, Donald Ray Pollock brings them to life and says, here's what's behind that. Here are the lives behind that. And there's no redemption in those stories of Knock 'Em Stiff. And that's also why it's very hard to read. But again, he shows us a way of life. Just like, Carol Shields, The Beans of Egypt, Maine, Carolyn Shute. She did that back in the 90s, or maybe it was late 80s, for Maine, a lot of the people who lived in the backwoods of Maine and in trailers. And so I think that that's where it may be difficult to read, but it's no more difficult than reading something about war in Iraq or in Afghanistan.
Well, as you say, it is relentless, mm-hmm. much like the poverty that these people grow mm-hmm. up in mm-hmm. these hollows in mm-hmm. southern mm-hmm. Ohio. And there were, as I say, great expectations for this book. And Kevin, you think he pulled it off?
Oh yes, one of the better books I've read. And I wanted to say too, my comparison would be to, as Jonathan Franzen knows sort of upper middle class suburbia and knows how to sort of interrogate characters and push them to their limits and have them make really terrible choices and then follow them after they make those choices. He's able to do it with impoverished rural Ohioans in the same way. And you just, it's excruciating, but mm-hmm. you can't stop reading it because he does it so well. He never lets anybody off the hook. And he does, you know, he weaves in some humor here and there so you have some breathing space.
Well, now he criticized us in the city of not necessarily catching the humor.
It's interesting. I wondered if Cassie had read anything about this, but I was told from someone who reviewed the book that that the people of Knock 'Em Stiff didn't like that book, or that he had taken a lot of criticism from people in that area for making them look so bad. Is there any truth to that? I don't know.
I couldn't. I heard whispers of it, but I got nothing. It was more like, you know, I don't know, maybe people were just saying it. Yeah. I can't validate it.
Well, it would be hard for them to think it was a pretty picture.
Yeah. That's right.
We're going to continue our discussion about books here on All Sides Weekend in just a moment.
David Dow has represented more than 100 death row inmates. Most of his clients were guilty, and he knew it. Some of them were guilty of monstrous crimes, and he's won only a few cases. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us why he represented them in spite of that, and what impact his work has had on his life and on his family. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss the campaign to put collective bargaining before Ohio voters. Also, questions arise about Governor Kasich's budget and the merits of recall elections. All that and much more on Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.
55 degrees in downtown Columbus, rain off and on throughout the day today, maybe a few thunderstorms this afternoon, and a high near 64. There's a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 48 degrees, and then partly sunny for Saturday and a high of 72, a slight chance of rain Saturday night, a low of 60, partly sunny on Sunday and a high of 84. All Sides Weekend continues.
Good morning, I'm Marilyn Smith. We're talking about books on All Sides Weekend with WOSU book reviewer Cassie Rose and poet and Capital University professor Kevin Griffith. And you can join the conversation. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter or give us a call, 292-8513. Well, this question of book banning rears its ugly head from time to time. The latest hue and cry in India, where a new book, Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India, is a topic for debate. And this was the subject of a story this week on All Things Considered. The book was written by Joseph Lelyveld. He's a former executive editor at the New York Times and former Times correspondent in India. And Vijay Joly is a spokesman for the Indian opposition party, the BJP, and he pretty much encapsulates the argument here.
If even a passing reference casts any aspirations on Mahatma's great personality and persona, then certainly we have a right to demand a review or a ban on the book.
And we also have sound from the author, Joseph Lelyveld, who defends his work.
If you think love has to be sexual, love between two men can only exist if it's sexual, then I guess this was sexual. But if you, as the book says, if you look at what the two men actually said and at their efforts in their time together to repress any hint of sexual urges, I think you'll find that at least I don't suggest that it was bisexual.
And he's referring to a time in Gandhi's life where he lived in South Africa, and there was a German bodybuilder who he befriended, and there is some kind of little bit of gossip about the relationship that the two men shared. Cassie, you have become familiar with this whole debate.
Well, I've read reviews about it, and what I think they're referring to, there are letters that are in the book between the two, and they're letters that have been in the public domain for a long time. But what is in thought or insinuated is that maybe there was a bisexual relationship here. But my take on this is when I listened to the NPR piece, and I had read the New York Times review of the book, which was a glowing review, came out a couple weeks ago. My take on it is that they're reacting more to a review that came out in the Wall Street Journal.
That the critics are reacting.
Well, no, I think that, and I don't know where, I don't know if I was reading online the NPR site where, because this is that's how I found the Wall Street Journal article. Mm-hmm. I was listening to the piece and reading online, and then they invoked this Wall Street Journal article and that they had read it in India, and that's when the first furor started. And my take is that this was the lighter fuel that started it, because I got none of this kind of problem reading the New York Times review. Especially, let me just read the first line of the Wall Street Journal review. And my take on it is, I think this reviewer used this opportunity to point out his opinion that because Gandhi was so revered by so many people worldwide, that nobody has taken a critical look at him. And he's saying that he's not the great guy that everybody thinks he is. And so then in this review, he says, you can discern from the information in this book that he wasn't all that he said that he was. And I'll just read the first line. Actually, it's the second line, and it starts out that great soul obligingly gives readers more than enough information to discern that he was a sexual weirdo, a political incompetent, and a fanatical faddist, one who was often downright cruel to those around him. Gandhi was therefore the archetypal 20th century progressive, intellectual, professing his love for mankind as a concept while actually despising people as individuals.
That's a pretty broad brush.
It is, and it's pretty powerful. And he goes through this article or review, is that he takes points from the book and he then says, basically, look at this. Look at the situation with his wife. And basically, the inference is he was abusive. Or look at these. And so he pulls out all of this stuff. Well, when you're reading this, you know, my reaction to it is, this is your interpretation of it, and I need to read the book. Well, what I've also read about the book is that it's not for beginners who don't know anything about Gandhi. You already have to know the outlines of his life and his philosophy. Mm-hmm. That's what the New York Times book review said. Well, if that's the case, then that does open room for people to start discerning or interpreting or whatever. So I think there's kind of something here that got reacted to in India. Whether or not, you know, they should ban the book, you know, I don't agree
with
that.
Well, we touched on this briefly earlier in the show, that there is sometimes great benefit to authors whose books are banned, or even when they get this kind of critical response.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, everybody just wants it more. And also, I've read that people are already, you know, in India, they're getting the book on Amazon. And so they're, whether they try and ban it or not, I mean, it's really, you know, are they trying to protect something here? I don't know. I don't know enough about it beyond what I have read.
Yeah, I think one thing, just to reflect on this, you think historically, one has to keep in mind that no matter how great a person's reputation or how great a thinker was, you know, they're always just human beings, and so they're going to be eminently flawed. We're all eminently flawed. You think of Einstein, who was a terrible father, terrible husband, never on top, you know, emotionally cold to his wife, never had contact with his children, really. You think of Miles Davis, who he was a known abusive husband in many cases. Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher who, you know, ignored his wife for years because he was in love with the wife of a friend. And, you know, what do you do with this? Or Ezra Pound, you know, the poet who was sided with the Nazis during World War II and gave, you know, how do you handle that? I think instead of banning things or making statements where you're going to ban something, you know, you just have to keep that in mind, I think. The only thing you're going to do is fuel the fire more and get people even more interested in it. So
292-8513, and Robin from Pickerington is on the line and wants to talk about her Nook. Go ahead, Robin.
Hi. I recently got a book about a couple of weeks ago, an e-reader, a couple of weeks ago, and I decided to get the Nook because I could get library storybooks. And in deciding to get an e-reader, I go through a lot of books, give them away, often to libraries for their library sales or whatever. And I decided to get the e-reader to help manage all the stuff around my home and my living environment, and also to reduce the amount of paper and to help the environment in general. I don't intend to stop buying books or getting books out of the library, but it's another tool for me to use. And I was delighted that I could get hundreds of classics that are in the public domain for $4.
Well, thank you very much for weighing in. And, of course, that may be how this whole thing settles down, that this is simply another tool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's another choice. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for calling. We do have an email from a listener who would like to defend Rod McEwen, and I think I made a little bit of a crack about him. But this writer says, I was very young, but I can still recite some of his poems. He touched an enormous group of readers and listeners, and perhaps he introduced poetry to some people who wouldn't have been interested otherwise. Extremely sappy, he writes, or she writes, yes, but in the 70s, I was at a sappy stage of life, and he enriched it. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your defense of Rod McEwen. You have brought a pile of books, each of you, and we're all waiting to hear what your book picks are for good reading for the next couple of weeks.
Do you want me to start?
Sure.
I would like to talk about Francisco Goldman's novel slash memoir called Say Her Name. This Francisco Goldman has been a favorite author of mine since his first novel called The Long Night of White Chickens that came out in 1992. He's a Guatemalan writer, lives in Brooklyn, and has written several novels before this one. This one is very different in that it is a memoir about losing his wife in a very tragic accident of body surfing in Mexico. And he's known for being a very elegant writer, and he certainly is here. And this is what one would call maybe a grief memoir, because he was, their relationship was 4 years. She was 30 years old when she died. He was in his 50s. They met in New York. And the narrator of this book is Francisco Goldman, and the woman, his wife, is Aura Estrada, which was Goldman's wife. And they dated for 2 years. They were married in 2005, and 2007 was the accident. So in the middle of the book, he goes into her childhood and her life in Mexico. She's was born in Mexico, or in Mexico, outside Mexico City, and writes about her childhood. He writes about her relationship with her mother and keeps going in back and forth with his grief of living without her, expresses her joy in life. She comes very alive in this book. And one of the things that struck me was when he said, he called it the daily surprise of happiness that he had with her. And I don't want to give away what happens in the accident. It comes at the end of the book. By the time I got there, I was so involved with these two characters or people that I had to put the book down and walk away because I just – and then come back to it because it – I knew that when I got the details of the accident, it was just going to be very difficult because it's one of those very unexpected things that, that happen in life. And – in the press release, he clarifies, there's a quote from him that where it's clarified what he fictionalized. And what he did fictionalize was things about her family and some friends and some things to keep things private. But for the most part, when you read this, I think you know that you are getting this very moving story from a man who loved his wife very much. So it's very much a love story, and it's also grief literature.
And the name of the book again?
It's called Say Her Name by Francisco Goldman.
Kevin?
I wanted to talk about the latest book by Henning Mankell. We both talked about Mankell. Mm-hmm. This was a big news release here, or big news in the publishing world. It just came out in March. This is the last Kurt Wallander novel, The Troubled Man. I'm a big fan of Mankell and the Kurt Wallander series. Kurt Wallander is this... well, now he's 60, but 50-ish Swedish detective who's very introspective, often depressed, and the detective stories are always secondary. Police procedurals are always secondary to his character, and really grown engaged with his character over the years. And Mankell was writing great Swedish fiction long before Stieg Larsson came around. He was there first, and everybody, and Stieg Larsson is pretty much an imitator, I think, of Henning Mankell. But I wanted to talk about this because I love the Kurt Wallander novels, and this is, Mankell has said himself that this is the last one, and indeed it is. And I wanted to talk about it not because I loved it, but it was a little disappointing, I thought.
A little disappointing.
People who are big fans of Kurt Wallander should read it. But it's very interesting. Often it reads like one of those movies that's like, number 7 in all these sequels, and much of the movie is just made up of you know, cutting and pasting from previous movies, you know, and a lot of that's going on where Wallander sees something and he's reminded of a previous case that happened in book two, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't want to give away too much of the book, but he obviously, it's clear very early what the conflict's going to be with Wallander. He's losing his memory, so, and he has to deal with that issue. There are some nice moments in
it. But yet he can recall these things that happened.
That's exactly right, yeah. But there's some nice moments. I mean, his daughter has a child, so becomes a grandfather, and that's very sweet. And at the end, that's how he decides to live out the rest of his life. He retires and just wants to spend it with his daughter. But it's called The Trouble Man, and it's the last Kurt Wallander novel. And I guess I would say if you're a huge fan of Mankell, read it. But a casual reader, I would start with, Cassie had this one too.
What was Faceless Killers.
Faceless Killers, mm-hmm. The first Wallander novel, which is absolutely outstanding. One of the best books I've ever read. Forget genre fiction or any other kind. Faceless Killers is an outstanding book. This one is showing its age and Wallander showing its age, I think.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left. Cassie, if you'd like to talk about another book, we probably have time for that.
Okay. Very quickly, I read, just finished last night, a book called Fatal by Jean-Patrick Manchette. And the reason how I got this book was that I joined the New York Review of Books Classics Book Club, which you can access online. It's nyrbbooks.com/bookclub. Anyway, the whole idea of being able to get a book in the mail, a surprise book, just sort of intrigued me. And so for 6 months, and this was the first book, it's a noir novel, so coming off of the Mankell.
Mm-hmm. So you don't know what they're going to send?
I don't. I don't know. And I kind of like that surprise. Mm-hmm. This was newly published by them this month. It's and they publish classics that have gone out of print or translations. And it's a noir novel about a woman who, in France, who's an assassin. It's a short, compact book. It's only about 91, 95 pages. And what I found fascinating about it was the way that the author goes into her methodology, being in a French town and how she finds the corruption and the people who have are angry at other people, vengeance, love triangles, and she sets them up and gets them to hire her. So it's, you know, noir is cynicism, violence, you know, sex, all that. But it's not that dark. It's entertaining. But you are from the viewpoint of the protagonist, is the perpetrator, is the assassin, which is always interesting to me because you're inclined to want the assassin to succeed when it's a bad thing. But I thought it was a great book, and I'm very looking forward to the book club.
And how often do they send you books? Once a month?
Once a month. And you can do it for 6 months or for a year. Oh. It's not cheap, but it was something I thought I could get a surprise in the mail.
Well, sometimes those guilty pleasures are worth it. Kevin, we do have about a minute left if you'd like to mention another book.
Sure. I wanted to mention a book I'm currently reading, kind of excited about, David Foster Wallace's last book, The Pale King. David Foster Wallace was, of course, considered a genius, won a MacArthur Genius Award, considered sort of a master of postmodern fiction. He committed suicide a few years ago, and he left bundles of papers, which he just called an assemblage, called The Pale King. It's not a straightforward narrative, but it's a wonderful read, David Foster Wallace's last book.
And that book has also gotten quite a lot of publicity. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both for joining me on All Sides Weekend. I'm Marilyn Smith. We've been talking with WOSU book reviewer Cassie Rose and poet and Capital University professor Kevin Griffith. And I trust that Christopher Purdy will be back with you next month. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus. Streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, service of WOSU Public Media. News from NPR is coming up next.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.